Morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Stop Trashing the Climate Press teleconference conference call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Cole Krawitz.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Cole Krawitz, and I'll be moderating today's press call. Today, our speakers will discuss the importance of the findings of a new report released today, June 5th, on United Nations World Environment Day, titled Stop Trashing the Climate. There will be an opportunity for questions and answers at the end of the call, and the call will last for approximately 30 minutes. Our first speaker is Brenda Platt. Brenda is the lead author of Stop Trashing the Climate and co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. She will provide an overview of the main findings of the Stop Trashing the Climate report.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us today to hear about how the trash we set out at the curb is directly linked to greenhouse gas emissions. We waste an awful lot in the U.S., 170 million tons each year of paper, plastics, metals, textiles, glass, compostable, and other materials. Almost 4 million tons alone are junk mail. One-third is packaging. There's a direct connection between the fact that Americans use one-third of the Earth's timber and paper and that deforestation accounts for as much as 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions, or that Americans generate 22% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions and produce 30% of the world's waste. For every item that is landfilled or incinerated, a new one must be extracted, processed, and manufactured from raw materials to take its place. This means more trees have to be cut down to make paper, more ore has to be mined for metal production, more petroleum must be processed into plastics. Trash is the tip of a very big iceberg. For every ton of municipal trash, about 71 tons of waste are produced during manufacturing, mining, oil and gas exploration, agriculture, and coal combustion. This requires a constant flow of resources to be pulled out of the earth, processed in factories, shipped around the world, and burned or buried in our communities. Needless to say, at each step, energy is consumed and greenhouse gases are released into the atmosphere. Stop Trashing the Climate, the new report we are releasing today, documents how this one-way flow of materials from extraction to disposal directly contributes to climate change. Indeed, we have found that wasting is linked to core contributors of global climate change. These include industrial energy use, transportation, and deforestation. When we minimize waste, we reduce greenhouse gases in these and other sectors that together we found represent more than one-third of all U.S. greenhouse gases. But we have good news, too. Stop Trashing the Climate provides compelling evidence that preventing waste and expanding reuse, recycling, and composting, that is, aiming for zero waste, is one of the fastest, cheapest, and most effective strategies available for combating climate change. Significantly decreasing the amount of waste we dispose in landfills and incinerators can offer climate protection benefits equivalent to closing 21% of the coal-fired power plants in the U.S. This puts the three R's, reduce, reuse, recycle, along with composting, in the same league as other leading climate protection proposals such as improving national vehicle fuel efficiency, retrofitting lighting, and protecting forests. We've also found that a zero-waste path saves more greenhouse gas emissions than investing in nuclear power, and likely at a fraction of the cost and liability. This week, Congress is debating climate legislation, and the Senate is already taking up amendments, including amendments to give billions more taxpayer dollars to the nuclear power industry. Such handouts, along with the current handouts to landfills and incinerators under the guise of renewable energy, are the exact opposite of what is needed right now. We're hoping that the information in this report is going to give legislators in Congress and elsewhere a good reason to streamline permitting of recycling and composting operations over nuclear power plants, landfills, or incinerators. One strategy that we highlight in this report for its critical importance is composting. By avoiding landfill methane emissions, composting in particular is a vital tactic in the battle to stop Arctic ice melting. Biodegradable materials are a liability when buried or burned, but they're an asset when they're composted. Why? Because in landfills, biodegradable materials, and we're talking here of food scraps, yard trimmings, paper, in landfills, these materials produce methane, and methane is an extremely potent and a short-lived greenhouse gas. And landfills are a top source of methane in the United States. Unfortunately, landfill gas capture systems represent a band-aid and a pipe approach that is not actually effective in preventing methane emissions to the atmosphere. We have the opportunity to stop these emissions by investing in composting, and diverting organic materials to compost will also return these nutrients to the soil. And we now know how important that is, as our soils are being depleted at an unsustainable rate. When we were doing this report, we looked at future projections for climate change, and we found that leading scientists, you know, now agree that atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations must decline over the next 15 years in order to avoid widespread and rapid climate change. But all our tools to measure greenhouse gas evaluate the effect of gases over 100 years. With this report, we're trying to change the dialogue to reflect the urgency of our situation. If we have less than two decades to curb greenhouse gases, then let's measure the impact of these gases over the short term and not over 100 years. Over the 100-year timeline, methane has a global warming potential 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide. But on the 20-year time horizon, this global warming potential jumps to 72 times that of carbon dioxide. So what does this mean? It means, for instance, that the impact of methane emissions for landfills in the short term are three times higher than reported, and it really points to the need to target methane now. One of the things we're recommending with the release of this report is that policymakers highlight the impact of methane in the short term by evaluating emissions on a 20-year time horizon. And this is also going to strengthen the case for stopping the disposal of biodegradable materials. Methane is so potent in the short term that we need to prevent its generation in the first place. Instead of being buried or burned, biodegradable material should be composted. Now, I want to say that methane from landfills is far from the end of the story. We also expose incinerators as energy wasters rather than generators and as significant emitters of carbon dioxide. Incinerators emit more carbon dioxide per megawatt hour than coal-fired, oil-fired, or natural gas-fired power plants. And because recycling conserves 3 to 5 times the energy that these facilities purport to generate, we label them as, quote, waste of energy, or WOE, W-O-E facilities. In other words, incinerating trash is akin to spending 3 to 5 units of energy to make one unit. So there's a huge potential for waste prevention, reuse, recycling, and composting to put us on the path to climate stability. But to realize these climate benefits, action is needed now. And we've identified a number of priority policies in this report. These include setting local and national zero waste targets, focusing on 20-year plans, eliminating subsidies to landfills and incinerators, ending the practice of waste incineration, stopping biodegradable materials from being sent to landfills and incinerators, and expanding the national reuse, recycling, composting infrastructure. But the climate benefits of a zero-waste approach are just the beginning. By cutting waste, we would not only better protect the planet's climate, we could also double or triple the life of existing landfills, eliminate the need to build extensive new incinerators and landfills, create jobs, build healthier and more equitable communities, restore the country's topsoil, conserve valuable resources, and reduce our reliance on imported goods and fuels. Sorting recyclables alone sustains 10 times more jobs on a per-ton basis than landfill or incinerator disposal systems. But again, the climate benefits are undeniable. We have the opportunity to close 21% of our coal-fired power plants by changing the way we view our waste. This could be the fastest, cheapest, and most effective climate strategy, and one that should be immediately front and center in our climate policy. Thank you. That concludes my remarks. Cole, back to you.
Thank you, Brenda. Our next speaker is Eric Lombardi. Eric is a co-author of the Stop Trashing the Climate Report and director of EcoCycle, a Boulder, Colorado-based recycling and zero-waste business. He will talk about the myriad benefits of materials reuse, recycling, and composting from a business perspective.
Good morning. This is Eric, and my little piece of the puzzle here in 2 minutes is to share with you the business, the economic numbers side. Brenda presented the overview on the environmental data. Inside the report, you'll find that we've done our homework and we've documented the environmental benefits of what we're proposing. And I can tell you from the business end that the economic numbers also support moving in this direction. The big question is, if you're not going to bury and burn, if you're not going to use landfills and incinerators any longer to handle the discards of society, what are you going to do with it? And the answer is fairly simple. You're going to sort it and you're going to sell it. A fact, in the last 7 years, the street value of recyclable materials, which I've been selling as a businessman, has doubled. The reason that the value of steel, plastic, metals, and glass has gone up is because it's a new world out there. With population increasing and resources decreasing, we've got consumer cultures in India and China increasing. The demand for resources is going up quickly across the planet. And the things that we're throwing in our trash cans, and this is a key concept, and the city of San Francisco has documented, there is a market for 85% of the stuff we're throwing in our trash cans. That's almost 100%. And I think what we're calling for in this report is a zero waste economy by 2030. Now, that means we have 20 years to increase from 85% market to near 100% of what we're throwing away. And this is completely doable once we get manufacturers understanding that if they design the products and packaging of our lives to be non-toxic and recoverable, then we will be moving into this area of a 90% recycling economy. That's what this report is calling for. Now, you don't get something for nothing. So what's the price we're going to pay here switching away from landfills and incinerators? There is a price. I think it's something America can handle. And what it means is we have to give up on our trash can, our mixed waste single trash can. That's the one thing that's standing in our way. And we're going to move towards a system that San Francisco, Toronto, Nova Scotia, and many other cities are already doing, and that's the three-can discard sorted system. One can for recyclables, one can for compostables, and one can for the stuff that's left over that doesn't have a market yet. In those cities that we find are doing it this way, like San Francisco and Toronto, they're already at 70 and 80% resource recovery rates. So for us to call for a society to get to 90% in the next 20 years is completely within our grasp. It is not an expensive proposition. And it is the question is, can America sort three ways? Can we have three bins instead of one? I'll close with that.
Thank you, Eric. Our next speaker is David Ziplett. David is a co-author of the Stop Trashing the Climate Report and U.S. coordinator of the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives. He will talk about the dangers of misguided national and local subsidies to incinerator and landfill disposal and highlight communities that are working for change. David?
Good morning. I work as part of a worldwide network focused on issues of waste. I do this because waste is at the confluence of so many issues that I care about. Equity, local economies, green jobs, community health, sustainability, and climate change. The climate and energy policies that will be established in 2008 at both the national and local level will play a large role in determining how we use natural resources moving forward. We are at a critical crossroads. Will we invest taxpayer money in more of the same waste incineration and landfilling, or will we invest so that the next 20 years bring significant gains toward reusing resources for the benefit of the climate? Will we build a new fleet of toxic and greenhouse gas-intensive incinerators and landfills, or will we establish resource recovery parks and composting programs in every community, bringing new jobs and tangible economic opportunities? The answers to these questions have immense implications for the climate, economy, and community health. At the behest of the waste industry lobbyists, subsidies in state and federal policies are being provided to both incinerators and landfills as so-called sources of renewable energy. These subsidies provide an unfair economic disadvantage to industries that reuse materials rather than destroy them. While no new commercial incinerator has yet to be constructed in the U.S. in the last decade, subsidies are encouraging dozens of proposals for new waste incinerators in communities across the country. Contrary to claims made by incinerator and landfill companies, the Stop Trashing the Climate report shows that these systems, including mass burn, plasma, pyrolysis, and gasification incineration, and landfill bioreactors, are a detriment to the climate and renewable energy goals. Incinerators and landfills are not a solution. At the same time that many communities are facing new incinerator proposals, the largest incinerator in the world, in the city of Detroit, is on the brink of being shut down for good. Last week, the Greater Detroit Resource Recovery Authority recommended to the city that it terminate the lease for the incinerator. the Detroit City Council has also created a budget that does not include the incinerator, and that would finally bring curbside recycling to the city streets. This incinerator has cost Detroit more than $1 billion of debt, money that is desperately needed for the city's schools and other public programs. It has also disproportionately plagued the area's primarily African-American residents with pollution linked to high asthma rates and other illness. Detroiters have organized an historic effort to shut down this toxic project, and they are closing in on their goal. The Detroit situation is not unique. In fact, community leaders in Bridgeport, Connecticut, have organized an event today to call for the termination of their incinerator contract and for a 75% recycling commitment to be achieved by the year 2020. Similar events are taking place today in communities facing both existing and proposed incinerators in places such as Tallahassee, Florida, Providence, Rhode Island, Los Angeles, California, Raleigh, North Carolina, and Massachusetts. Meanwhile, in Washington, Congress is considering the Renewable Energy and Jobs Creation Act of 2008. In addition to providing incentives for some truly green solutions, the bill would extend tax credits to incinerators, landfills, and coal gasification plants. This will cause even more waste pollution and global warming. To address the climate crisis, we need our taxpayer dollars to support more wind, not more waste. The Stop Trash in the Climate report shows that shifting taxpayer money from waste disposal to waste prevention is a strategy that no energy or climate plan can afford to pass up. As the terms of the climate debate get discussed in Washington this week, waste prevention and strengthening recycling and composting should be a central strategy to achieve climate protection targets. Waste is an issue that is universal to every city in America. There is no community that does not have the ability to significantly and cost-effectively reduce their climate footprint through better source resource management. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. Our next speaker is Peter Sloat. Peter is a recycling specialist with the City of Oakland, California. He has 18 years' experience in the recycling industry, the last 7 of which have been in Oakland. He will talk about the role that city government can play in planning the next generation of discards management systems. Peter?
Good morning. Oakland not only believes a 90% reduction of material to landfill is possible, we've made it a municipal goal. Oakland continues to exceed California's mandated 50% waste diversion requirement. We're at 59%. But the growth of population and the growth in consumption in California sends approximately the same amount to landfill now as it did in the early 1990s. 50% diversion in California has not halved tonnage to landfills. More accurately, we've kept it from doubling. So zero waste is a way for local government to build on our considerable investment in recycling and get beyond just treading water in the face of rampant consumption. Local waste management systems have become the end of the pipeline repositories for an increasingly toxic and not to mention resource-intensive stream of products and packaging and, of course, methane-producing organic materials. The costs associated with managing this growing and increasingly complex discard stream are escalating for local governments. Most experts agree that landfills will eventually leak toxins into the groundwater. So zero waste represents a prudent risk reduction strategy for local governments to address these environmental and financial liabilities. Can Oakland do it? Yes, absolutely. How will we do it? That's a big topic, but here are the main components. We'll redesign our discards management system to incentivize material recovery and treat landfilling as a last resort, not the default option. We'll ensure there's adequate industrial land to grow processing capacity, particularly for materials that can't be exported, such as concrete and organics. This also represents critical infrastructure for sustainable urban redevelopment, not just for keeping stuff out of landfills. And we'll support and promote extended producer responsibility at the state level, which is advancing quite quickly in Sacramento, by the way, and largely driven by local government action. And we'll maximize all of the recycling programs and infrastructure we've built over the last 20 years. You can view Oakland's zero waste strategic plan at zerowasteoakland.com. Thanks.
Thanks, Peter. Our next speaker is Raquel Tinderhughes, PhD. Raquel is a professor of urban studies at San, San Francisco State University, and a national expert on green-collar jobs. She will talk about the opportunities for local, economic, and workforce development through recycling, composting, and materials reuse.
Hello, thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to talk about job creation in the recycling and reuse industries, particularly for people in low-income communities. I want to start by just reminding us that cities all over the world are facing a series of environmental challenges. They include air contamination, the rising cost of petroleum, epidemic asthma rates, running out of landfill space, and community opposition to incineration. And the point that I want to make is that as policymakers address these urban environmental challenges, they have an opportunity to simultaneously address issues of poverty and social inequality in their cities. And the way this would happen is by supporting policies that link green economic development to programs that train low-income men and women with barriers to employment for jobs, in this particular case, in the recycling and materials reuse sectors. The point is that recycling and reuse industries are triple bottom-line industries. They're good for the environment, they're good for the economy, and they can promote equity and reduce poverty by providing pathways out of poverty for people who need living wage, family-supporting jobs. The waste recycling and reuse industries already generate large numbers of good jobs. They currently employ over 1 million people. Recycling is a major industrial sector comparable to automobile manufacturing and mining, and surpassing waste management. Recycling creates more jobs than conventional waste disposal measures. And the point is that public policies that move the country towards zero waste and resource recognition would result in the creation of thousands of new jobs, all of which would be local and difficult to outsource. Spending by employees in the recycling and reuse industry leads to additional jobs. And in addition, the recycling and reuse industry generates about $13 billion in federal, state, and local taxes. Recycling also stimulates the development of green technology and environmentally friendly projects, which in turn creates new jobs and more jobs in related sectors. Additionally, jobs are created locally by attracting industries that convert recovered materials into finished products. The main point here is that the recycling industry has radiating effects across many sectors. Although many of the jobs in recycling and reuse require higher levels of skill, most of the jobs are manual labor jobs, ideally suited as entry-level positions for low-income men and women with limited skills and education. And my in-depth research with employers in the recycling and reuse industry reveals that entry-level green-collar jobs in waste reduction, recycling, composting, and materials reuse are very good jobs. I've empirically shown that they pay living wages, that they provide workers and their families with health benefits from day one, that they involve a lot of independent thinking and teamwork, resulting in high levels of job satisfaction, that these are meaningful, community-serving, environmentally improving local jobs, and that they provide workers with opportunities for occupational mobility. In terms of low-income workers, these jobs have low barriers to entry, and they provide workers with on-the-job training. We're talking about jobs in driving, sorting, construction and demolition, deconstruction, composting on a large scale, and a very wide range of jobs associated with materials reuse, which range from design to production and include graphics and distribution. I think the kinds of policies that Peter was outlining in Oakland give us a great example of the opportunity to link environmental policies to economic development and job growth. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Our final speaker for the call is Rafe Pomerantz. Rafe is president of Clean Air, Cool Planet and former deputy assistant secretary of state for environment and development under the Clinton administration. He will talk about the immediate climate imperative to decrease methane emissions.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be on the call. Been some great presentations. I'll be very brief. To say a little bit about the conditions in the Arctic and why what everyone has had to say is so relevant. Temperatures have radically increased in the high latitude environments of the Northern Hemisphere. Basically, everybody knows this. We've seen this in huge reductions in sea ice in summer, particularly in the Arctic, to record lows last year. Greenland, much of the ice sheet is shrinking in mass, contributing to global sea level rise, which is now at about 16 inches per century. And permafrost across the region is changing as buildings are falling, structures and roads are having great difficulty, particularly existing ones where the permafrost is no longer sustaining them. What could be done about this? One of the things that is obvious in the short run, we need to buy time for long run changes in energy systems that can bring down CO2 emissions and concentrations. And the key short run opportunity is to lower the emissions and therefore concentrations of short lived gases, like methane in particular. Methane over the next 20 years is going to have virtually the same impact on global warming as global CO2 concentrations, as was mentioned, because it's molecule for molecule, it's quite much more powerful than CO2, but has a shorter lifetime. An intense national and global effort to reduce methane emissions could, or would, really lower the rate of increase of warming and might, in fact, lead us to an absolute decrease. Consequently, everything we could do in that regard becomes crucial. And the methane from landfills is one very important and available method to reduce methane. So I'm a sort of hearty endorser of the initiative. It's got to be done here. The U.S. has to take a lead. Every community has the ability to do that. And it obviously has tremendous local benefits, but it also has a global benefit to the future of the planet. Thank you.
Thank you, Rafe. We're now ready to turn it over to question and answer. If you could please direct your questions to a specific speaker, that would be great.
The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, you can press the number 7 or the letter Q on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order that they are received. First question comes from Nora Goldstein of BioCycle Magazine. Nora, please state your question.
I would like a bit more clarification on what is going on public policy-wise in Washington this week that could have, that the results of this report could affect changing some of the suggestions, policies being proposed in what's going on in Congress. There were some things quickly mentioned, but what specifically does the Stop Trashing the Climate report suggest in terms of public policy initiatives, tax credits, infrastructure building, for example, adopting a federal and national waste reduction goal, anything of that nature?
Nora, this is Brenda. Thank you for your excellent question. There's a number of things that Congress is taking up this week, and one of them is what the targets for carbon reduction should be and the caps for that. Is it 80% below 1990 levels by 2050? And one of the main findings of our report is that the three R's, along with composting, that is the zero waste task, is one of the readily achievable measures to help put us on that climate path. And so as Congress looks at amendments and handouts to the nuclear power industry, for instance, this report will be, you know, another tool in their arsenal to show that we probably don't need those handouts, and that moving towards policies for promoting recycling and composting will do it. In our report, we identify 12 priority policies for action now, and these include eliminating the subsidies for incinerators and landfill gas to qualify as renewable energy. We're calling for a per-ton surcharge on landfill and incinerated materials. Many European nations have adopted significant fees of $20 to $40 per ton. I mean, if that was implemented in the U.S., it would be several billion dollars to help fund the infrastructure that we're talking about. To give you an example, I don't know if, Rafe, if you would like to address any of the other issues that Congress may be taking up, or Dave Siplett on the subsidies for incinerators, please add.
I would just say that, this is Rafe Pomerantz, that apparently there's been a 2 or 3 day debate on the climate legislation, which is comprehensive in its reach in terms of greenhouse gases. I don't think that's going to pass. In fact, the Senate may be ending the debate today. But what we do know is that two presidential candidates now are strongly committed to a comprehensive reduction in U.S. emissions through a cap-and-trade program. I assume landfill emissions would be part of that. So perhaps, I think it's very likely that next year Congress will be debating, the President will be initiating an effort to begin the reduction, a serious reduction of U.S. emissions that should include landfills and recycling. And I think that this debate is only going to intensify as we see increasingly strong signals from the Earth's climate that things are warming rapidly.
If I could this is David Sippa, if I could add one point, and that is that I think very, very central to this report and to supporting real climate change mitigation strategies that are equitable is also a polluter pays principle, and that incinerators and landfills are both large polluters. Any policy moving forward really should, the burden really needs to be on the polluter, and that revenue generated from any program, I think moving towards solutions like recycling and composting that provide real jobs and provide real reduction benefits at the local level. Are really important, and also any subsidies that are coming forth in climate policy, that they're not going to incinerators and landfills and other climate change greenhouse gas polluters, but they're going to solutions to climate change that have local economic development benefits.
Let me add one thing. This is Eric Lombardi. A fundamental mistake was made a few years ago when Washington decided that trash was a source of quote-unquote renewable energy, along with solar and wind and others. And what we're calling for is the path to zero waste. There is nothing renewable about waste at all in our vision. And so that's one of the fundamental things that has to be changed rapidly, is that our discards are not a source of renewable energy.
Great. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Lisa from E&E Publishing. Lisa, please state your question.
Okay, thanks. This is probably for David. I was wondering what you think the potential is for some of these relatively newer plants by Plasco and Ultra Energy, for example, that claim to cleanly burn municipal solid waste into syngas, and what you think the environmental and economic benefits or shortcomings may be in these processes.
Great. Thank you for your question. I think that all the issues that we laid out in the presentation and in the report that document the life cycle impact of wasting, of waste disposal, basically when we destroy a material rather than reusing it, the next material needs to be made from materials that are dug up from the ground, that are processed in factories, that are shipped across the world, that have immense greenhouse gas emissions rather than if we're reusing materials. In addition, the new facilities that are being talked about, plasma and pyrolysis, that many communities are seeing proposals in around the country, the claims that are being put forth by the industry, we find time and time again, are largely without basis as far as them being clean technologies. There hasn't been an independent that's been provided, and to the contrary, we've found that these facilities produce dioxins, heavy metals, and the same contaminants that communities that have been dealing with mass burn incinerators have been dealing with and suffering from the health consequences from for decades now. And this is absolutely the wrong way to go for both the climate and for community health.
Great. Next question, please.
If anyone anyone else has a question, you can press the number 7 or the letter Q on your telephone keypad. Nora Goldstein, please state your question.
This question is directed to everybody because you represent different groups. Who are the most likely allies to work with in making sure that these policies proposed in Stop Trashing the Climate, the data that you've put forward, that need to be exposed to this information, need to be brought into both the local level, public policy-wise, state and national, allies that we may not, that the industry itself, or allies that may not appear initially to be, or may not be apparent, I guess just looking for your thoughts as to who really needs to come together to make this sort of thing happen, to make this kind of change institutionalized.
Nora, this is Brenda. I'll just start off the response here. Interesting question. When we set out to do this report, one of the things we looked at is who's our audience for this. And we essentially identified three kind of groups of stakeholders. One was recycling and solid waste professionals who could really use, who are desperate for this information to show how expanding what they're already doing is going to help protect the climate. So that's one. But the other audience was public interest groups that are working on climate change. We want to get recycling on their radar screens as a critical tool that can be used for putting on the path to climate stability. And, of course, any local, not local, but local, national, and state legislators, decision makers that are working on protecting the climate, we want to get this report in front of them. In terms of key allies, I'd say the benefits of pushing for zero waste is so widespread. Professor Pinderhughes addressed this quite well in terms of jobs and urban areas. So connecting with the green job movement, pushing for a green economy is critical. Other environmental groups. There's groups working on protecting the soils and sustainable ag. The fact that compost is going to help restore our soils is a very critical benefit in linking it with climate change. And there's a wide list of allies that I think we definitely need to be working with to push this agenda forward. Others want to respond?
Well, I would just say that this is Raquel Pinderhughes. I would just say that, you know, we've seen an enormous amount of community-based resistance to incineration, community opposition to incineration. And I think that the potential for the community activists engaged in that struggle to demand strategies and solutions that are associated with zero waste and green job development is tremendous. And I think we're beginning to see that at the local level.
This is Peter in Oakland. The one thing I'd add to this part of the conversation is that the investment that local communities have made into recycling infrastructure is considerable, and I think that local governments undervalue that in the face of these incineration schemes, and that the cost effectiveness of the investments to date in recycling just can't be underestimated.
Next question.
If anyone else has a question, you can press the number 7 or the letter Q on your telephone keypad.
If there are no further questions at this time, we will conclude our call.
There are no further questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us for the Stop Trash and the Climate Press teleconference. This will conclude our call for today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. We thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your line at this time.